and then this internal part of its body coming in and out, in and out. And people think that the animal's giving birth because, you know, often they think it's blood, but it's really poop.
Just toss them overboard when you're sitting having lunch, or, you know, just anything like that.
The classic.
We actually were joking about setting up an OnlyFins account.
Here's to us all swimming through the shit and making more sense of it.
Wild and unprotected, planet Earth we can't neglect it. Nature sexy, we need this place, so please respect it.
Hey everyone, welcome back to Wild and Unprotected. On today's show, our guest is Guy Stevens. He is the chief executive of the Manta Trust. Guy, welcome to the show.
Hi, nice to be here.
Hey Guy, how's it going?
Pretty good. Yeah, nice to see you guys.
Yeah, I'm glad we were finally able to get this recording in. I know we had spoke a couple months back and you've been a busy person, so I'm glad we were able to fit this in.
My pleasure, yeah.
So yeah, Guy, for the audience out there, let's just dive into a little bit about yourself. Let's talk about you and your early career and what you do now.
So for me, I mean, I grew up in the UK, in the southwest of the UK. I was very much exposed to nature and wildlife, and grew up by the ocean, was always snorkeling and, you know, looking at fishes, and I was definitely someone that from an early age knew that I wanted to study nature, study animals, and then I kind of gravitated towards fish. I had lots of fish tanks and fishes in ponds, and so it was a sort of a natural progression to want to study marine biology. I went to university, got a undergraduate degree in marine biology at the University of Plymouth, and then from there progressed through to getting a job in the Maldives, which is where I first encountered manta rays, and that's really where my passion for these giant fish species began.
That's amazing. And not to get too far ahead, and I don't know if we could talk about this, so we might cut it. But I believe you guys are working on a project out in the Maldives. It sounds like a terrible place to have to work.
Yeah. Well, that's where it all began. So 2003 is when I first moved to the country, and I was living there year round working as a marine biologist. Really, it was a sort of a glorified snorkel guiding / dive master job. It was, don't get me wrong, it was awesome. I was being paid to go out and see manta rays, to you know, take guests to see them, and I really wanted to do more than just guiding. So that's when I started to collect data on the individuals I was seeing, taking pictures of them. I realized that you could identify every individual using these spots on their belly. And from there, it progressed to the creation of a formal project, which today is called the Maldives Manta Conservation Program. It's a Maldivian registered charity. There's a team of about 15 or 16 staff that work in the country year-round, comprised of Maldivians, but people also from other parts of the world. And we have ongoing full-time research projects for the last 15 plus years, which conduct work on behavioral ecology, the impacts of tourism, reproductive behaviors, you name it. If it's an area that's of interest to science, and especially if it's important for conservation management, then we will try to conduct that work in the country. And we're lucky to have populations of both reef manta rays and oceanic manta rays in the Maldives. So it's a great study location, and, you know, it's where I did my PhD, and it's also supported about 30 plus master's students. And currently there's a about half a dozen PhD students that are also conducting their work in the Maldives, all under the umbrella of the MMCP. So yeah, it's a great location, and it's also happens to be a very nice place to spend your time. It is exactly what you think. It's this beautiful tropical paradise with crystal clear, beautiful waters. And so yeah, it's not a bad place to study manta rays. In fact, when I was doing my undergraduate, I learned to dive in the UK in very cold, very poor visibility, rough oceans. And once I graduated, I definitely had a mental note to think, there's no way I want to study fish in the UK. I want to go somewhere nice and warm. So yeah, the Maldives was a good decision, I think.
Yeah, I could imagine it was. It's amazing how much of collaboration that seems to be out there with different organizations and different countries nowadays, especially in the warm tropical places like the Maldives, where you can, you know, study almost year round. Let's talk about manta conservation and essentially the time of year it kind of takes place. I know, for example, whales normally have a season of, you know, January through, you know, June timeframe, depending on where you're at. What does that look like for manta?
Well, it's different in, as you'd expect, different places. There is often seasonality, but in the tropics, usually less so. And in the Maldives, there are mantas to be found year round. It just depends on which species you're studying and which location you're based at. So they're not static in the country, but if you're able to move in the country with the migrating animals, you can access them year round. So we have lots of bases where the staff are located, and in some of those locations, the staff have to sort of maybe move study sites, and in other locations, they have them nearby all year. So, but generally, I mean, manta researchers globally will kind of hone in on the peak periods for their locations, and it varies in different places. And you know, to your point about having, you know, research in the tropics and globally, there is definitely a lot of collaboration that's necessary. It's something that is really one of the fundamental pillars of the Manta Trust, is having an organization that is comprised of lots of different projects, lots of different people with different skills that are all helping each other to further this common goal of conserving these species and really conserving the oceans. The mantas are obviously our focus and their relatives, but they are a charismatic species and a flagship species for broader ocean conservation. So really, we use the mantas as a way to engage people in the oceans and the importance of protecting our seas and everything that lives in it. And, you know, that's a message that that we're really, you know, pushing, and hopefully it forms the key sort of underpinning for everything we do, whether that's education or the research as well.
Yeah, that's awesome. Before Koji moves us on kind of to the next topic here, let's discuss the types of mantas, because, you know, you've kind of referenced already, you know, different types of mantas populate in different seasons and different places. Let's talk about those two types you hit on earlier.
Yeah, let's broaden it out even further. So the family that contains the mantas is called the Mobulids. Mobulidae is the actual family or subfamily, depending on what taxonomic group you go with. And these are all the world's among the world's largest rays. There are currently 10 species, and they're all filter feeders. So they have these very specialized filter plates in their gills, and they have these modified fins at the front of their heads called these cephalic lobes or cephalic fins that they use to funnel their prey into their mouth and then out over these filter plates in their gills. So this family of 10 species is broken down into what we would generally refer to commonly as the devil rays. They tend to be a bit smaller, less commonly interacted with by divers because they're smaller, shyer. And then there's the mantas. And the mantas currently comprise of two different species, although there is a third species that hasn't formally been described in the Caribbean. So that species is restricted to the Caribbean, maybe the whole of the Atlantic. And it's a hybrid of the other two species. And the formally described species of mantas are the reef manta, which are found throughout the Indo-West Pacific oceans. So they're absent from the Atlantic and the very eastern tropical Pacific as well. And reef mantas, as their name suggests, tend to be more associated with reef habitat, so along the continental coasts of the Indian Ocean and the Western Pacific, and also around coral atolls, so places like the Maldives, obviously, we've been talking about. This is a focal hotspot for reef mantas. But reef mantas tend to be a bit smaller, although they're still pretty big. They grow to over 4 meters in wingspan. They tend to be more reliably and predictably interacted with by humans because they aggregate in areas that are easier to find. And then there's the oceanic manta, which is the biggest ray of all, often it's called the giant manta as well. And they grow up to 7 meters in wingspan. And that's a pretty colossal size for any fish.
Yeah, you know, just the size of a bedroom.
I've never seen a 7 meter individual. I've seen some that I think must have been, in excess of 6 meters. And it's just, it is really crazy to have an animal that big be so close to you. I suppose the nearest comparison would be being sort of in touching distance to something like an elephant on the savannah. It really is this humongous creature that will actively engage and swim right up to you in lots of places around the world. So the oceanics are circumtropical. They extend up into the more temperate oceans, but they tend to aggregate more in slightly cooler coastal regions and at offshore pinnacles. So some of the most famous locations would be the Revilla Hidos Archipelago in Mexico. You've got places like south of the Maldives around a very remote atoll called Formula. You've got parts of the eastern tropical Pacific around Mexico and Ecuador, where I've just been, where you have these big aggregations of these oceanic mantas. So they're really spectacular creatures to see and dive with.
Yeah, we had our experience with, I believe, the Pacific mantas in Kona, Hawaii, and we're able to see them do their feeding underwater in big circles, barrel rolling, literally swimming chest to chest with you. That was some of the most, like you said, spectacular. One of the most spectacular things that you can witness is seeing an animal that big. No way were they 6 meters across, but pretty big and pretty awesome to see that many manta rays all feeding on krill and doing somersaults for us. That was really interesting to see.
Yeah, Kona's a great spot. I've never made it actually to that night feeding spot. I would just point out those are actually reef mantas that you would have seen in Hawaii. And that is the easternmost distribution of reef mantas. So the Hawaii is kind of like the most furtherly eastern that species gets, also down into French Polynesia. They don't cross the Pacific any further to the seaboard of Mexico or California, etc. But they're still, it gives you an understanding. And so those reef mantas that you would have dived with would have been about sort of 3.5 meters in disc width. So if you, imagine an oceanic manta that's twice that size, that gives you an idea of just how much bigger they are. But Kona is a great spot. It's a obviously it's a sort of somewhat artificial situation because the mantas are attracted using these lights, but they would naturally be feeding in the area. They've just basically learned to forage in a very predictable way around these lights because it concentrates their food. And it's a great way to allow tourists to interact with these animals. And, you know, if the mantas don't want to come, they can just go and forage elsewhere in a natural way. But it's over the years, it must have, I don't know, millions of people must have seen their first manta rays in this way in Kona. So pretty special sight.
I agree. And I think it's really important for conservation too, just because it allows people to essentially interact with the animal and see the animal in person, and that leaves a mark, you know, that leaves an impression that's long lasting, and now they're more likely to get involved because they get to see it. And then on top of that, it's amazing to see what a learned behavior does and how a learned behavior of an animal has now become a tourist attraction. That's almost its own industry in Kona. It's pretty cool.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, for us, something that we're very focused on, and we really understand that if you want people to protect the oceans and the creatures that live in it, you have to make them care about them, and you have to create connection to the species themselves and to the broader ecosystems. And mantas are one of those species that really grab people's attention. They sort of pull you through the looking glass and captivate and engage people in a way that few other species can. And it's that connection, it's that awe-inspiring emotional response that people get when they have that one-to-one encounter. That's something that you can never get through reading a book or looking at photos. Of course, those, they are of use and they help, but it's that personal experience that really makes a difference. So while there are issues that need to be managed around tourism activities with these animals, you know, we have issues around boat strikes and unsustainable tourism numbers, you know, people behaving irresponsibly, operators sometimes behaving irresponsibly. This happens all over the world with every species where there's a tourism angle to the encounters. But the overall, I think, takeaway is that we shouldn't let the negativities negate from the massive benefits that come from giving people those experiences. And the more that we can do that, the more that we can create a sense of appreciation for nature, then that can only be a positive. So, yeah, I think that Kona is a great example of that. We have similar tourism attractions in the Maldives and, you know, really in dozens of locations around the world where mantas exist. And I think that's something that will hopefully continue to be a really important aspect of conservation for these species.
Absolutely. You said it. Hey, Guy, you know, speaking of creating that connection with the species, let's take a step back and talk about, you know, the reason why you created Manta Trust and the intention behind it.
Yeah, well, I was working in the Maldives. I'd started the Maldives Conservation Program. You know, the Maldives is, you know, it's a place where mantas are pretty well protected. There are pressures from tourism, but there is no targeted fishery. There's not a huge pressure from bycatch fisheries there. So you have a healthy population. They are protected nationally. The population seems to be stable. So it's a great place. And the mantas are doing well. But as I started to travel away from the Maldives to visit colleagues who were working in other areas and going to places myself where there were mantas turning up in fish markets, I realized that there was a need for a more global approach to conserving these species. They were being targeted through fisheries for their meat and also for their gill plates, which were being used and still are being used in traditional medicines in Asia. So you have these pressures from fisheries, you have pressures from tourism, you have pressures from habitat destruction, the climate crisis that obviously is affecting the the reef habitats that many of these species live on and in. And so I realized that we needed to have a strategic approach globally to undertake research to provide the scientific knowledge that could be used to leverage management to conserve these species. And that's the reason why I started the Manta Trust. I realized that there would need to be some focal organization upon which to build that structure. There needed to be an umbrella organization to bring people together, to attract funding, to give us the charitable status needed to ensure that you could have the credibility and the framework within which to operate. And so that's what I set about doing in 2010. And, you know, the charity was formally set up in 2011. So it's been sort of 12, 13 years now of me working on the Manta Trust. And before that, another sort of 7 or 8 years while I was working in the Maldives. So that was the process. And that was the reason why I started the Manta Trust.
Well, I would say it's a pretty damn good process, first of all. And I think it's fairly unique. The amount of collaboration that you guys do amongst your projects, I think is pretty much second to none for any major organization in conservation. And I think it's a step in the right direction. I think there's a lot of, you know, focal point organizations where a lot of the focus is inward, instead of outward for collaboration with your different projects. And I know people are going to go through social media as they listen to the show. And I highly encourage that for, you know, just exploration of Manta Trust and seeing the projects within it. Let's talk about the structure of Manta Trust and, you know, how you kind of got that idea.
Well, I realized that if you want to achieve things on a global scale, you need to have global structure, but you also cannot have a dictatorship and impose your centralized sort of opinions on individual projects, which want to have their own autonomy, and quite rightly so, have their own flexibility in decision-making processes. So I think it's important to note that the Manta Trust is this umbrella organization, and we have affiliated projects in 25 countries. I think we're up to about 28 or 9 affiliated projects right now. But those are all independent projects, aside from the Maldives, because that's the sort of the founding project that I started. All of the others, they were started in some cases before the Manta Trust was officially formed. Some of them focus on other species and other topics entirely, but they all have a common component that focuses on mantas and devil rays. And the idea is that we, as a centralized organization, provide them with the resources. So that can be expertise, it can be funding, and strategic oversight. So we're saying, look, we've done the bigger picture thought process of what are the priority conservation areas, what questions do we need to address, what legislative processes do we need to go through, whether that's CITES or CMS or national efforts, where are we putting our effort, where should we collectively be focusing? And then from that strategic plan, we go to those affiliates and we say, look, this is what we're trying to do. How can we help you achieve these? And how can you feed back into this global plan? But it's entirely up to them. They have their own governance. They have their own funding opportunities and so on. So it's a two-way process. It really is a collaboration. And I think it's been successful because that structure, it makes people have ownership and feel like they have autonomy, but they have support when they want it from us in the Manta Trust itself. So, yeah, that was the thought process behind it. I think it just happened organically. I never really sought to impose this sort of global brand on other people. I just wanted to help in a way that would be most effective to achieve conservation. And for me, it's the people and the collaborations that are the source of that success. It's not about, you know, scientists or conservationists going in somewhere and starting a project. Ideally and certainly intentionally, we try to find local partners who themselves are keen but don't necessarily have the resources, and help them to to grow their projects and to build their capacity. So that might mean scientists coming in to help them, but ultimately we want those projects to be locally governed and owned, because that's the only way they'll be successful long term. Is, you know, going in somewhere, setting something up, there's always a shelf life to that, unless you build the local sort of support and ideally ownership of that project.
Damn, that is phenomenal. And Koji, that sounds a little familiar, doesn't it?
Yeah, definitely.
We can't dive too much into it. Future project of ours. We'll fill you in on the back end, guy. We'll just say I took some inspiration, from that model, that you guys have built. Cause obviously, you know, there's been some time since we last, talked, and, that's been really influential. You know, to me, autonomy really allows for ownership and accountability. You know, like you had said, and that promotes better work, in my opinion, you know, from a leadership perspective. And when it comes to something as important as conservation, keeping those two pieces of, you know, essentially personality, aligned and ready to go, I think you get better results. And I definitely think that it's showing for you guys, you know, providing resources, allowing for autonomy, and feeding into a global feeder system essentially is amazing. And you guys deserve props for that.
Well, thank you. And I think you touched on something there. I think it's important that the mantas are the figurehead of the organization. The mantas are the thing that we are trying to get people to care for and connect to. And the conduit to that conservation goal has to be through local ambassadors, because in the eyes of the community, whether that's the children or the fishermen or the politicians, they are much more likely to be supportive of and see a path to that protection if they are spoken to and guided by people that they connect with the most, and quite rightly so. So, and I see it in the Maldives. You know, I can go to a school full of lovely Maldivian children and stand up and talk about mantas and why I love them, why I'm passionate about them. And, you know, of course, you know, generally, you know, the kids really listen to and appreciate what I'm saying. But if one of my Maldivian colleagues stands up and gives that presentation, I can't speak Dvehi, but I do my best in English, and they have brilliant language skills. But it's not the same as speaking to them in their local language in a way that they can see, I could do this. You know, I could become just like, you know, my peer, and I could be the next, you know, manta scientist or conservationist or educator. They can directly see a route to that career, which is much harder to see if you're some, you know, white person from another side of the planet coming into their community and talking to them. So, you know, it's a no-brainer for me. Like, the long-term goal for the Manta Trust's work in the Maldives would be that we don't need to have any one from outside of the country coming in to run the project. Obviously, having outside skills and support and knowledge and collaboration is something that I never want to see end entirely. But in terms of a day-to-day governance and a day-to-day running of the project, I want it to come from within the country, not externally imposed upon them from outside.
That keeps it localized, you know, and we kind of want to see that community locally around you build from the inside out, rather than, you know, come from the outside in and have this skewed way of telling these messages and getting these points across. That's really interesting. I wanted to kind of move us forward into some of the projects that the Manta Trust is currently working on. And you know, how what we just covered is impacting, you know, mantas as a whole.
So what do you guys currently have going on? What are some of kind of your big marquee projects right now?
Well, I could talk about Ecuador, where I just spent the last couple of weeks. It was an initiative that, I should first say that our affiliated partners in Ecuador, a lovely gentleman called Michelle Guerrero, he's an Ecuadorian who started off as a dive instructor. He had his own dive company in the country for 27 plus years, and he fell in love with the mantas at a site called Isla de la Plata, which is about 4 hours in a car and along bumpy roads east of Guayaquil, in a small little village called Puerto Lopez. And you can sort of head offshore about 40 kilometers to this protected island, and around the island the mantas aggregate seasonally, usually from around about sort of July through to about now, so sort of middle end of September. And so Michelle was interested in learning more about this population. He started a foundation to protect mantas and all megafauna in Ecuador. And he's been collecting data on this population now for about a decade. And so Michelle, affiliated with the Manta Trust, and we've been able to help him to gain more funding, to build local collaborations. And this summer, we had the opportunity to bring a whole group of manta researchers from the Eastern Tropical Pacific to Ecuador to work together on a sort of a blitz research program across a couple of weeks. And it was thanks to one of our funders, Carl F. Buscher. It's a watch company and jeweling company in Switzerland. They funded the expedition, so we were able to buy some satellite tags, some more acoustic tags. We've been able to bring in colleagues who are specialists in underwater ultrasound and stereo video photogrammetry, which is the way that you can accurately measure manta rays, photo ID work, tissue sampling. So we would like, let's bring in loads of people. Let's focus at this site for 1 month. And while we have all of these specialists there from Mexico, from Costa Rica, where else do we have? Peru, Galapagos colleagues as well came in. And then, you know, other folks from other parts of the world, all coming together to help out with the research, to do education initiatives with the local communities. So we gave presentations to the national park staff. We did some education activities with the local schools. So sort of blitzing education, the research, and then having all of those researchers together, we could come up with a regional research plan. So a way to say, look, everyone's kind of working on their own thing in this region, but wouldn't it be much more effective if we put our efforts together to do a collaborative projects on genetics or on tagging and tracking? And so we used that opportunity to initiate some of those ideas, and obviously to support the work that Michelle has been doing there for many, many years. So that's a good example of where the Manta Trust can bring everyone together, because we have affiliated projects in the region. And it's a great opportunity where we can provide some funding through one of our sponsors to help Michelle and his work in that location. So, you know, it's really important because we still know very little about this population. And as I said, it's a population that turns up at Isla de la Plata for, you know, 3 or 4 months of the year. But where are they the rest of the year? Well, what we believe is they are probably spending a lot of time in Peru, so just south of where Isla de Plata is. And while the mantas are in Ecuador, they are protected nationally from fisheries. But as soon as they're in the borders across into Peru, there's no protections for the devil rays, and we still know that the manta rays are captured in Peru through illegal fisheries and through bycatch. So, you know, there are bigger issues and questions that can only be addressed using these collaborative studies. No one project can really answer these questions themselves. So that's one of the projects that we've got ongoing, and I think that it's the beginning of something really great in the region, because there's a lot of really young, excellent local researchers doing good work on mantas and devil rays in that area.
That's an amazing project, and I want to hit on two points that you had touched on with this Ecuador project. One, the community outreach that you guys have done, working with education and schools and things like that, that is amazing. And that's something that we believe in is a big part of conservation, is, you know, getting local organizations, local conservationists and researchers involved with their local community, and especially the kids. You know, we talked about it, you know, just we touched the surface when we were talking about the Maldives, but it seemed to be a really big part of the trip and project that you have in Ecuador, which is absolutely amazing. And the second piece is the international border change and the protections that happen. Personally, I think the way Manta Trust is set up as an umbrella organization working with these different affiliates is key in being able to work on issues and tackle the issues such as you know, different protections over different borders. You're able to work with different state and local governments because you're affiliated with a project that's within, you know, their country lines or their state lines. And it allows you to work with, officials and potentially change, you know, the lack of protection that's there, which I think is an excellent opportunity for you guys. But it also, and most importantly, gives you guys understanding too. You know, having this, you know, essentially global organization and global brand, like you had said, gives you insight that most other organizations don't get. You get to see place to place and how protections and rules are different. And I am a really big backer of how that sets you guys apart. That's phenomenal. And I'm really hoping that it is a real big catalyst kind of for change, and especially for studying the different species going forward.
Yeah, well, to take the second point first, although there are obviously differences in every location, every project, there's also a lot of similarities, and that's where having this global sort of group of people at the top, whether we can lean on our scientific advisors, our policy advisors, funding advisors, etc. You know, the Manta Trust, the core team of the charity, which is kind of spread all over the world, but obviously we're a UK registered organization. You know, we are there to provide that higher level advice and knowledge, because while there are differences, which we will learn from our partners in each of these locations, there is a lot of the same issues in these locations. And you can apply a lot of the same solutions to these issues at a local scale. And so giving that knowledge and expertise is really helpful, and that advice is usually very valued for these project leaders in these affiliate locations. So, yeah, having a regional or global approach to management or education, policy. These are all things that are really beneficial, especially for a species that has highly mobile tendency. You know, management of a species that crosses borders has to be at the, you know, the scale of the population itself. You know, it's useless just saying, well, you know, we protected mantas in Ecuador on paper, and then, you know, slapping ourselves on the back and saying, job done, they're protected. When clearly, you know, we see individuals all the time in Ecuador that are caught up in fishing line and fishing nets. Well, you know, where's that happening? Is that happening to them in Ecuador through bycatch? If it is, well, then clearly we may have protected them on paper, but in reality, they're still being impacted by human activities. Or is it happening elsewhere throughout their range when they cross into another country? So absolutely, you need to have the regional approach. And this is where working with frameworks like CMS, so that's the Convention on the Conservation of Migratory Species, this is where that organization is really helpful, because there is an organization specifically set up to help manage migratory species. And, you know, by working through CMS with the folks at CMS, we can then apply management regionally to mobulids through our network under that program. So, yeah, management is key. Strategically, we try to assist all of our projects in thinking outside of just the confines of their specific location, making those connections, providing them with the opportunities to conduct science and you know, policy work that's going to have a broader impact. And that's really key to our global strategic planning. And then the education component, you know, is something that increasingly I've realized over my, you know, time working on manta rays is probably the most important thing of all, because we need a generation that's coming to care about these animals more than the current generation, because clearly we don't care about them enough to protect them in an effective way, because populations are declining rapidly around the world. Our oceans and, you know, biodiversity in general is massively declining. I think, you know, 70% declines in the world's biodiversity in the last 50 years or so. I mean, that's really scary to think that these animals will continue to disappear from our planet. And so we need the next generation to be the protectors in a way that we have not been. So education of the future generations for me is really, really important. But bottom-up conservation, while it's really important, is not the only way. You have to think about top-down as well. So, you know, collecting the science that's going to inform management decisions, that's a huge part of what we do, and working on the policy. You know, it's the most exhausting part of the work we do. It's the most difficult. It's the sort of the less glamorous aspect of the work we do. You know, going out, diving with manta rays, taking pictures, publishing science, that's all much more fun than, you know, working with governments, working at an international level with CMS or CITES, so trying to regulate trade, you know, sitting in meetings, writing very dry proposals, which often get rejected, getting involved in politics that has nothing to do with manta conservation, but nonetheless is really important if you want to achieve your goals. That stuff is really, really key as well. Because we need to have protections on paper, and then you have to have enforcement of those protections, so effective management. You know, if we're to conserve what's left in the time that it takes for the next generation to be more appreciative of the things that we should value in the natural world. So all of that is to say that education is great. It's heartwarming. It's something that is really important. The science is the pillar that provides the tools and the knowledge upon which to make solid policy decisions. But the science can only take you so far. So without that policy and those protections through government and international frameworks, then things will just continue to get worse, because there'll always be people that will exploit these species for their own profits. And, you know, you put that all together, and that's really the nuts and bolts of what the Manta Trust is doing. We're trying to coordinate all of that work globally, to help people do each of those things in their areas in a way that's most effective for the global conservation of these species.
Wow. Have you guys ever run into a politician or an organization of politicians that was giving you guys just a really hard time and all you wanted to do was just drag them by the hair into the water and chunk them in with some manta rays and be like, how can you not want to protect this?
Well, that is, you know, you've touched upon one of the best ways to change people's minds is to, and I have definitely done this, is taken politicians, taken them out, put them in the water, put a mask on them and said, look at this amazing creature. How can you not be, you don't have to even say anything. You just have to let them experience it and see the change in their mind. And that's what we need to do with all people who have the opportunity and the position to make a difference for these creatures. So, yes, absolutely. I wish I could do it more often. I wish I could take prime ministers and presidents and wealthy business people, etc., to experience the oceans, to experience nature more, because I feel if we were all a bit more connected back to nature the way we used to be in generations gone by, I think we would all care a little bit more about it. And we would all be a bit more concerned about how quickly we're losing it. I'm eternally frustrated by politics and politicians, but I understand that we need them. We just have to get them to move up their list of priority, the protection of species in our oceans. And definitely one of the best ways to do that is to either directly expose them to those experiences, or to have their constituents, their voters, be exposed to it and to be caring about it. And they will put pressure on them to make the changes that we want to see. But all of that comes back to getting people to have a greater connection to the oceans, because it's easy to justify through science why you should do something, but it's much harder to get people to act on those justifications unless there is a monetary driver or an emotive driver. And emotions are always more powerful than money, but money is also, of course, very powerful.
Yeah, that's interesting that you mention connecting people back to nature. I think that's a running theme that we're running into with every guest that we've had on our show is, you know, it's one thing to, like you said, look at a photo or listen to a topic on conservation or protecting a species or habitat or whatever the example may be. But it's, you know, directly picking them up and plopping them into these habitats and saying, hey, this is what we aim to protect. Look how special this is. It's like going and seeing a nature documentary for your own eyes. I think that helps engage people and let them experience it for what it truly is, rather than what other people say it should be. So that to me resonates, connecting back with nature. I think it is so vital for us as a species to coexist with other species within nature. So, you know, there's a perfect imbalance, you know, there's a perfect imbalance that humans must share with every wild species here. And if we overstep that, then who are we to have more than these animals that were here for much longer than we were intelligent creatures? But I'm sorry to cut you off. No, I mean,
I was cutting you off. I, you're exactly right. And I think, you know, it's more, I think, urgent than that. I think selfishly, we not only should, but we have to conserve biodiversity on this planet, because we cannot survive without it. We depend on a healthy natural world for our own survival. And you know, we can keep on moving in a direction that will lead to a more impoverished planet, and humans are not going to go extinct anytime soon, but the world will be a less functional, healthy, happier, and easier place to live in if we continue in this current trend. And so, you know, I think one of the most important things that we can all do is try to get the people around us, our friends, our family, try to get them out into nature in some way, to get them off their phones and to give them those experiences that allow them to have a bit more of an understanding and appreciation for nature. Because watching something on TV is great. You know, putting a VR headset on someone is even better, but it never quite has the impact than just having someone have that experience directly. And it doesn't have to be getting on a plane and going across the planet to dive in the ocean with a manta ray. You know, I live in Nova Scotia, and you know, I get out every day and I try to go out, you know, looking at the birds and the nature and walking in the trees, and I don't know how, I just couldn't survive if I was taken away from those experiences and had to live in a concrete jungle. That would destroy my soul. And I think for so many people, they are so disconnected from nature that they are unaware of the joys and the health benefits that come with having that exposure to nature. We are rooted in nature, and I think that the way that society has removed itself from nature in so many ways has been detrimental to our sense of self and community and well-being. And I think that hopefully there will be a shift in society that reconnects us. And for me, certainly, that's one of the things that I feel we could and should all do to improve the natural world and to improve our own lives.
Yeah, I agree 100%. I also think it's kind of funny that, you know, as almost a society, especially in the States, you know, we're so removed from nature. And, you know, there's a lot of people who get into those concrete jungles, like you said, the hustle and bustle of the city, never get to go out and connect outside of maybe, you know, a tree that's in the city or a park or anything like that. I think it's an incredibly funny concept that a lot of the people that are perhaps against conservation or, you know, don't understand it or don't partake in it at all, their concept of a vacation is going out to nature. I always thought that was the funniest thing, that the same people that will live up in the high rises who don't give two shits about what's going on outside of, you know, their day-to-day business grind or whatever it may be, one of the first things they'll think about is like, oh my gosh, I can't wait to go to Cancun. Or I can't wait to go out to Bali and be in the jungle and things like that. And you're like, wait a second. You're putting that much emphasis on a vacation and you're so excited for that, yet you want to do nothing to protect that nature that you're going to visit or that you want to escape to. I always thought that was incredibly weird.
Well, that's the disconnect that we have from the natural world. And, you know, I think there's not the understanding that there should be about the interconnectedness between going to, say, Cancun and getting out on a boat and going and seeing a humpback whale and thinking, wow, this is cool. But then not understanding the fact that that whale only exists because of a healthy ocean that is driven by a healthy climate, etc. So I think, you know, we are all connected to nature, and we, I think, often do not appreciate just how connected we are, and it is to our own detriment if we don't make more people understand that. But that's just, that all goes back to the education that we talked about. It goes back to making people connect to the natural world, and that's, you know, not an easy thing to do, because, you know, humans lived in a planet that was, you know, we were trying to isolate ourselves from the things that were dangerous, and we created a very safe space to be in, away from the natural world in many aspects. And, you know, I understand why most people don't want to expose them to things that that are alien to them. So it's a big challenge, but I think it's achievable.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's not something that happens overnight. So it takes organizations like yours to really bring that aspect to light. And I like that you touched on policy. Well, I don't like it, but I like that policy was brought up in this, because it's not usual that we have a guest speak on that aspect of their efforts. So I want to shift gears a little bit. And I see on your website for Mantitrust that you are able to adopt a manta ray, piggybacking on what we said about connecting to nature and bringing the public into, you know, having that that personal connection with nature, not only by experience. I think adopting a manta ray can definitely help you get to that point. But can you elaborate a little bit on what that process is and what you've seen with offering manta ray adoptions in terms of people being more aware and being educated more in that sense?
Sure. Well, I guess this goes back to the point I made about connecting people to nature. And it's one thing to show someone a species that they've never seen before. So you create that connection an animal in the ocean, in this case, let's say a reef manta ray in the Maldives. But if you can then tell them not only, you know, the species that they're looking at, but you can tell them about the individual. And we can do this with manta rays because they all have these unique black spots, predominantly on white bellies. And these spots are unique. It's like a fingerprint. The mantas are born with these patterns. They don't change. So we can recognize every manta that we see. We can put them in a database and we can follow their lives. That's really important scientifically. It gives us this understanding of the bigger picture about what the population is doing. So how long do they live? Where do they travel? How often are they reproducing? What age do they mature? These are really pillars of conservation management questions. So that's the science. And when we started learning about these individuals, of course, you get to know them. You learn that they have different personalities. They're exposed to different threats. Some of them get hit by boats. Some of them get bitten by sharks, etc. So all of a sudden, you have a window into the lives of individuals. And so for us, when we talk about the work that we're doing and we talk about the individuals, people are obviously way more connected to the personal stories of individuals, just like we're much more connected to the stories of individual human beings in the documentaries that we watch on TV. And that's often why conservation becomes about the person instead of the science itself, which I'm not a big fan of. I think if you want to create a long-term conservation program, it should be about the science and about the organization. And it's not about one individual, because that individual will ultimately disappear, and really it should be about this this broader message and connection that we're trying to create. So if you can shift the focus to the animals and you make people care about those individuals, that's a great way to engage them. And the adoption program is, you know, it's not that they actually get to own that individual or adopt that individual. They're just having a way that they can give a contribution to the charity, and we will provide them with a certificate and some information about the animal that they've selected to adopt. And in some cases, people can also give a name for that individual. So we often say that, you know, people around the world, when they're diving or snorkeling, etc., if they're able to find an individual that hasn't yet been identified, then we often ask them to, if they want to, give it a name. And so that is something that people love as well, because it really connects them to these animals. Again, it's all about connection. And, you know, an adoption program is a pretty commonly used mechanism in conservation charity, especially with with charismatic megafauna. It's a way for people to feel connected to the individuals and to give something back to the charity. And so you can go through our website, you can adopt named individuals, and we use those funds obviously to feed back into the charity operations and the conservation of these species. So yeah, everything we do, I should be very clear, we are a registered charity, we're audited by the Charity Commission, we are fulfilling our charitable remit. So, you know, the funding that we get through donations, whether those are individuals giving us small amounts through adoptions, we're talking about, you know, $10, $20, very small amounts, or much larger donations or grants or sponsorships that we get, all of this has to go through our charitable operations and functions. So, it's just another great way for us to connect with people and to raise funds for the charity.
Yeah, that's amazing. And, you know, talking about connection, Koji, you think it's time for some wild stories?
Yeah, let's hop on into it. So, Guy, this is one of our favorite parts of the show, bringing some stories to light that you may or may not have told, or the public doesn't usually get to hear. This is thinking like fireside chat, you know, maybe we're hanging around drinking a beer and there's a story that slips out. Is there anything in your career or your early research days that that an event maybe speaks out and you want to be able to share, whether it be on a research mission, in the lab? You know, what's some wild things that the public doesn't usually hear from Guy?
Well, lots of stories, I guess. There's, you know, I've been privileged to have spent a lot of time underwater, done thousands and thousands of dives with manta rays. You know, I'm probably among the person that's seen and spent more time with manta rays than anyone else. And that's a great opportunity to have this window into the lives of these creatures. So, you know, I've seen all these amazing behaviors from mantas pooping all over the heads of other divers and, you know, vomiting up all their food. They have this amazing ability to evert their intestines. So, you know, so when you see like a party blower, when you sort of blow into these, you know, spiral tubes that kind of come out, it's not quite like that, but many sharks and rays, and certainly manta rays, have a cloacal opening, so that's kind of where their feces comes out, but it's also the same opening that they use to give birth from. So this you know opening directly leads to the intestines, and the intestines can actually be turned inside out through their cloacal opening. So they can sort of it kind of looks like they're coughing. So you see a manta kind of sort of goes like this, and you'll see an intestine that, you know, I can't see in the camera, but it extends out several feet out of its cloaca. This big pink sac that comes out, and it's essentially turning it inside out and extending it out through its cloacal opening, and it cleans out its intestines and cloacal opening. So it gets rid of all the food and the parasites that might be inside, and it shoots it out like a party blower. So it sort of goes out and in, out and in, out and in, out and in. So if you're underwater and you see a manta doing this, there's this brown, it looks kind of reddy brown manta poop, and then this internal part of its body coming in and out, in and out. And people think that the animal's giving birth because, you know, often they think it's blood, but it's really poop. And because it's an internal part of their body, it kind of can look maybe like it was giving birth. So it's a weird thing to see. And, you know, the first time I saw it, I was like, what the heck is going on?
That's what I wanted to ask. Did you know about it before you saw it for the first time, or did you see it and then have to learn about it?
I didn't know the first. I mean, the first time was probably back in like 2003, so 20 years ago, and I was like, "What You know, I didn't think it was giving birth, but I thought that it was pooping, but I was like, is that normal for its internal organs to come out? And then I went away and did some, well, wouldn't have been Googling back then. It would have been like Yahoo or something. And you know, sort of tried to see what was out there. And sure enough, there was some information on sharks and rays doing this. And but you see it quite regularly, especially at cleaning stations. Mantas seem to increase their digestion, I think, at cleaning stations. Cleaning stations are a place where mantas come to rest, to get cleaned, but also to, because it's quite warm water, they come into the shallows to rest and I think to digest after they've been doing these deep foraging dives. So they go down deep, it's cold, they feed, they come back up to the warm, shallow waters, and then they expel the undigested food. And I should say that as well as kind of diverting their intestines, they often sort of vomit up other food that's caught inside their gills and sometimes their stomach as well. So not only does the bum come out the back end, but they can turn their throat out through their mouth as well. So you kind of see all of this poo and vomit coming out of both ends of the animal.
I'm realizing now how important this species is to the water column, to be able to just give all these nutrients.
Exactly, and that's a really good point. We actually think that mantas that forage offshore, feeding on prey sources that would be maybe deeper and further away from the reefs, they're bringing back to the reefs and regurgitating and defecating a lot of food and nutrients for all of the smaller fishes that then feed upon it. And these cleaning stations are full of animals that, you know, it's pretty funny. I can sit there and if I watch a manta that is starting to sort of vomit and defecate, I quickly realize that you want to get up current. And all of the fish realize that a good place to be is down current, and they start gobbling up all the food. And then there's usually some tourists that are just kind of sitting there going, and then very quickly they become engulfed in manta poop. And you know, obviously that's not as an enjoyable experience as being up current of the manta poop. So although I actually have colleagues that unlike me rush into the manta poop with little nets and they scoop it up and they try to collect it, because that's really, really important information. You can gather the not only the feces, but also if you can collect it, the vomit, because that will tell you what the mantas have been feeding on, and you can do analysis on that prey. Not only can you look at it and you can identify potentially the species, so is it a species of plankton or shrimp that might be in a specific habitat, you can also look at the carbon and nitrogen signatures. So you can look at the isotopic structure of the prey, and that tells you something about where it's feeding as well. So yeah, lots of good science to be gathered from these really interesting behaviors.
I'm really glad that you guys pulled the thought of how it's enriching the environment with nutrients and the science. All I could think about this entire time was mantas must have the most active butthole of any animal in the ocean. They have shit going out. They got babies going out. They got body parts going out. That's pretty insane.
Body parts going in, because all sharks and rays have internal fertilization. So most fish just release eggs and sperm into the water, like huge quantities of sperm and eggs, and you know that will mix in the water column. Some of the eggs will get fertilized, and a very, very small proportion of those will survive to adulthood. It's kind of a numbers game, right? A less investment in reproduction, you're just going to, you know, put out the eggs and the sperm, and then if you're lucky, one in 1,000 or one in 1,000,000 or maybe even one in several million might survive to adulthood. Sharks and rays focus the other end of the spectrum. They put a lot of investment in reproduction, just like like humans and most mammals do, going to give birth to just one pup after a gestation of 13 months, 12 or 13 months. So that female is very choosy about the male that she mates with. But because they have internal reproduction, it means that the males actually have to mate with the females. And sharks and rays have two claspers, basically like two penises, and they will mate with the female using that clasper or claspers to insert the sperm in through the cloaca of the female. So yeah, poop in, babies out, claspers in. It's definitely a two-way street.
It's a one-hole fits all.
And you know what's even stranger is sometimes you'll see like a tail sticking out of the cloaca of a manta ray, and you're like, what the heck's going on there? And if you look closely, sometimes like 3-foot remora has shoved itself up into the cloaca opening of a manta. You know, I guess sometimes being in a safe space is worth the discomfort of being, you know, in the anus of a manta.
Butt stuff.
We're going to need to see some underwater photos or footage of this remora tail. Now the audience needs it.
Well, just Google it. There's definitely videos and pictures out there. In fact,
he's like, we don't have any. We don't have any of that.
You can look inside the, I think I've got it in the guidebook somewhere. There's this brilliant book, Guide to Mantas and Devil Rays. And there's a picture, I think, in there of a devil ray with a remora stuck inside it. And in fact, it's not just inside the cloacal openings, but the remoras will... they'll go inside the mouth. So there's a species of remora that only lives inside the mouth of a manta. So it attaches itself into the top of the mouth. They're quite small, and they're often in pairs, and they literally live inside the mouth of a manta. Other times, other species will go in through the gill slit. So you'll just have the tail sticking out of the gill slit. And, you know, these all must be really discomforting. Imagine yourself, you know, your whole life, you've just got animals stuck to the outside of you. They leave these scars and abrasions where they're always attached to the animal, you know, swimming inside your cloacal opening, going inside your mouth. You know, it must be pretty discomforting to the mantis to be covered in these hitchhiking remoras.
I was going to say that sounds like a symbiotic relationship, but it doesn't seem like the mantas, you know, get too much out of it unless they like things swimming in and out of their butthole.
The question, the jury is still open on how symbiotic it is. My opinion is it skews more towards parasitism than symbiosis, but there is some evidence that the remoras do eat the external parasites. So, you know, there probably is some benefit, but overall, I would say it's possible that the negatives, at least for the shark sucker remoras is probably overriding. And here's, yeah, I guess some pictures you can see of them. I don't know where you can see that, but you might be able to see there you go.
Yep, that middle one.
The version of the pooping, yeah.
For everyone listening on Apple Podcasts or Spotify, make sure you check out the YouTube version to see that picture.
Yeah, and it's, as I said, it's all in the Guide to Mantas and Devil Rays of the world. And you know, or you just Google some image searches and you can see.
You might have to be careful with that one.
Yeah. The more you like study these animals, and the more, I mean, I think this is one of the things that I feel as a scientist is really fundamental to understanding your study subject, is you've got to observe it. I mean, look at some of the best and most well-documented studies in the world are of animals that people have spent decades observing. And we're lucky that you can observe manta rays, certainly reef manta rays, really frequently and consistently. And if you want to understand the species, you have to look at it. You have to have a visual world view into its world. And so for my students and colleagues, I always say to them, you know, become a naturalist, observe your surroundings, look at what's happening. If you want to understand why a manta is going somewhere, you've got to really have an insight into what's driving its movements, what's its behavior, what's its needs, what's its concerns, etc. So good old-fashioned observation in science is really, really important. You can put a tag on a manta and you can track it and it can say it went from here to here, but you don't know why it did that. What were the things that made it move around its habitat? So yeah, observation, not only can it be really entertaining and really fun and an enjoyable experience, it's a really important window into our understanding of these species.
Yeah, thank you for that. That's something that we really try to encourage, is get out there and observe, but most importantly, experience, you know, because this can be done through citizen science. And it can be a pretty damn good time, especially, you know, in the water, whether you're vacationing or whatever it is, you know, all of that stuff, is incredibly helpful towards the science, towards the organizations, you know, like your own, and is a great way to really get involved.
Absolutely. We have a ton of citizen scientists out there that contribute massively to our work. You know, a lot of the data that we collect is given to us by people out diving and snorkeling or even just out on a boat, providing us windows into the world of these animals that we wouldn't be able to have otherwise. So, you know, whether it's mantas for people that are lucky enough or able to experience them in the wild, or whether you are walking out and observing the birds, you know, that data can be used by scientists in your location. You might not think it, but that knowledge is so key to helping us to understand and protect these species. So get out there, get observing. There's some amazing apps out there these days that help you collect the data and get it directly to the scientists. So yeah, become a citizen scientist, be part of the process of helping to learn about and protect these species.
Yeah. And if there are any citizen scientists out there, that are, you know, diving with mantas, even if it's on a touristy level, how can they get in contact with you to pass along some of that data?
They can go to our website. We have a whole section dedicated to people to submit their images or their video or their observations. You know, it doesn't have to always be something accompanied by imagery. But obviously, if you do collect sightings, if you have pictures or video, and if you have the location and the date, we will add it to the database and we will always provide you with feedback too. So if you send us a sighting of a manta ray, we'll tell you which manta ray it is, where it's been seen before, etc. So we try to give people back the knowledge from the information that they give us. But go to our website, go to idthemanta.org, and you can submit your sightings to one of my colleagues who will process it and feed back the information to you.
That's awesome. Well, I think we're in a good spot to wrap. Koji, what do you think?
Yeah, I think we covered a lot and learned a little bit too much information about mantas. You can never learn too much. That's right. Guy, it's been an incredible show. Thank you for diving into the Manta Trust and you and your career and giving us and our viewers some insight on what you do day in and day out. I've had a blast learning about your organization and hope to maybe one day be out there in the Maldives with you.
Well, my pleasure. And you've been more than welcome, both of you. Yeah. I would love to take you out and show you some of the mantas that I've come to know over the years and tell you about their lives. And yeah, that would be fun.
Yeah. I think it'd be a great trip. We'll have to set it up. Stay tuned.
Awesome, guys. Thank you for tuning in today's show. We'll see you on the next one. Thank you for tuning in to this episode of the Wild and Unprotected Podcast, brought to you by Wildscape Productions. Follow us on social media at Wildscape Productions. For more information on our documentary series, Shoreline Stories, visit wildscapeproduction.com. Stay tuned for our future episodes, as we have so much more in store for Wild and Unprotected.